This is FolkAlley.com. Joining us today in the Folk Alley studios is Grammy Award-winning musician Tim O'Brien. He has brought with him his guitar and his bouzouki. Tim, thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here with you, Chris. It's nice to be back in Kent.
Yeah, absolutely. Your music isn't really bluegrass. It's not really old time. It's, you know, you've done your own songs, Irish songs, an album of Bob Dylan songs. How do you see yourself in this folk music world?
Well, you started getting me kind of worried there because I remember Bill Monroe used to talk about different kinds of music, and if it wasn't to his liking, he'd say, it's no part of nothing. And it's not no part of bluegrass, it's no part of nothing, that's what he'd say. I mean, I like to think my music is part bluegrass, and it's got part of that in it, but, you know, it's just whatever occurs to me. I like all the roots forms, and I just kind of recombine them however I can. You know, when you're playing by yourself, people say it's folk music. That's kind of how it sounds with an acoustic guitar. I guess if you had an electric guitar, you could be a rocker just by yourself, but it's usually you're usually a folky if you're by yourself.
Well, you've done some electric stuff, too, and some contemporary influences creep into your music as well. When do you think the contemporary element of this music happened? Do you think it was with Newgrass music in the 70s, or did that start before that?
Before they started calling it bluegrass, it was creeping in there. You know, I think Bill Monroe, for instance, he used the influences of the blues that he learned from Arnold Schultz, and as well as the square dance music he learned from his Uncle Penn. Combined with his awareness, I think, of the jazz bands in Chicago when he was there with his brothers on the radio, and kind of fused a new kind of thing.
Now we look at bluegrass as sort of this old-time kind of music, but when it happened, it was almost revolutionary. I mean, the purists were even kind of a little afraid of it.
Monroe himself was kind of a radical innovator in his day, and then, as the way tradition is you know, whoever innovates as they get older, then they go, oh, well, this is traditional music that I play. I started the tradition. You know, everything's been added to bluegrass on and on through the years. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. So like you said, Newgrass Revival, those guys really added a rock and roll element to it in the performance mode, as well as the kind of grooves they played on the instruments, but they still played bluegrass instruments. And then they would go back and dip into the old stuff, too, just to make sure that it was part of the same line, you know? So I think anything goes in this music.
How did the purists feel about it at that time? You know, when Newgrass came out in the 70s, how did the folk purists feel, and or the bluegrass diehards?
Well, I think they were kind of the fans. Some of them were a little bit put off, I think, you know. And then you started seeing some festivals kind of cater to the traditional crowd, and some other festivals cater to the progressive crowd. But the good thing for the promoters, I mean, if you talk to the promoters, they probably liked it because they were bringing new kids in, they're bringing new audience members in, and a younger generation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the kids like Sam Bush, he was a big fan of Bill Monroe and Flatten Scruggs and all that, Stanley Brothers and that kind of stuff. But, you know, going to high school, he was playing rock and roll and some jazz in the jazz band, and he felt the need to include it all in his music, and so it ended up being what they call Newgrass. But it's got to change a little bit to survive, and as long as there's some kind of reference to what went before, there's no way you can avoid what went before, really. It's all kind of in there somehow.
It almost seems now that audiences expect or even accept this sort of contemporary elements in the music. They're okay with the Waybacks doing Led Zeppelin 2 at Merlefest, for instance.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I think, you know, it's just you play to your audience and you develop your own audience as you go on with a career in music, I guess. And that's the way I look at it. You know, I think the fans, they're kind of just going to hear what they like to hear. They don't think so much about, you know, what kind of music is this. I like this music, so they go. And so it's, you know, it takes care of itself, I think.
It seems to me that maybe the purist isn't as prevalent as they once were.
Well, they're still there. I mean, it's a great thing, actually. The music grows in all directions, you know, and the roots of it grow and the branches grow. So you have the Del McCurry's bands, is, you know, one of the top bands on the scene in recent years, and they're doing a straight traditional sound. And then you have somebody like Nickel Creek, or let's say Old Crow Medicine Show. I mean, Old Crow Medicine Show is kind of, in some ways, it's kind of retro, but it's got like a rock and roll attitude that's different, the way they put up their show across. I don't know. But, you know, it's like there's always new stuff coming along, and there's an audience for, you know, some of the audience will only go to see the Del McCurry type of thing, and some will see all of it, and some will only see the progressive side of things. It's just there's something for everybody in it.
When did you discover this music growing up? Was it in your family?
Yeah, my hometown is Wheeling, just not too far from here, just slightly, maybe 100 miles from here. And they used to have the WWVA Jamboree every Saturday night, and I'd listen to the radio and listen to the live performers. And they would have some of the stuff there. They had the Osborne Brothers, Red Allen. They had Jimmy Martin there time and time again. And so I got to see some of the hear and see some of the music performed there. But I think it was Doc Watson, when I saw him on TV and saw him playing a few songs like Deep River Blues and Black Mountain Rag, I thought, man, that's the way you play guitar. That's really the way I want to learn how to play guitar. And I've tried all these years. I keep trying.
In 2005, you released two albums at the same time, Fiddler's Green, which won you a Grammy Award, yeah, and then Cornbread Nation. That's a pretty big project to put out two albums at the same time. And now your new album, Chameleon, is kind of a departure. It's just you, completely solo. Why did you decide to go this solo route on this new record?
Well, it was one of the only things I haven't tried to do, is just to play all by myself. Although I've done it quite a bit live, and it's been a way to sort of make, you know, a little bit more living, you know, without paying the band. And then when I get the band together, I really enjoy that, and try to work the career so that I am paying my bills. And so having a band, it costs a lot more, and sometimes you can't make as much money. So to pay the rent and put the kids through school and stuff, I do a little more solo gigs. It was finally time to make a whole record that way. It's another way of looking at the music. I love playing with other people, and there's something about that I miss doing solo. But when you have an audience there, you're relating to them. The interplay is more with the audience, and it's always going to be there anyway, but is without other musicians. And I don't know, it's just something about the solo thing, it brings people closer to the music. They're not, it's not so much of a performance, it's more like you're kind of hanging out together. Hmm. And I think that's nice. That's a nice way to get at the music.
Well, you're holding your bazooki.
I'm going to hodl. I'm going to yodel and hodl.
How about we get you to do a line?
I'm going to do a song about my hometown. I talked about Wheeling. Growing up in my neighborhood in Wheeling, West Virginia, used to be a guy come down our street selling vegetables. Had his own truck, had his name stenciled on the side, Mr. Magna, Magna's Produce. He'd get to the top of our street, he'd roll down his window, start singing a little song about what he had for sale. It sort of sounded like this. Melons, I got melons, cantaloupe, honeydew, watermelon too, I got melons, I got strawberries, bananas and grapes and grapefruit too, I got strawberries. But I'm just a little Italian man, I can sell more food than most men can. I load my truck to drive to town, all the pretty women come swarming around for my produce. I got nice produce. Get your grocery list ready when you hear me. I got tomatoes, nice tomatoes. I got Italian and beefsteak and breadless too. I got tomatoes. I got green beans. I got green beans. I
got broccoli, kale, and cauliflower too. I got green beans. When I rolled down the sides at the top of your street, I shout my name from the driver's seat. This maintenance truck coming to your door. Buy it up this week and buy some more next Tuesday. Every Tuesday, yeah, yeah. Well, that's Magna's produce right to your door. Plan your supper when you hear me. Get your groceries ready when you hear me. I got potatoes. I got a aubergine. I got a okra. I got sweet corn.
That's Tim O'Brien playing live in the Folk Alley Studios, a song called Magna's. That's off your album Chameleon, the most recent record.
Yep.
This new record of yours features you playing a whole handful of different instruments on just about every track. When people think of Tim O'Brien, what instrument do they think you think they normally associate you with?
I'm kind of mostly associated with a mandolin, and unfortunately, I don't have that today. I got everything else. I'm carrying around a banjo and a guitar and this bouzouki, which kind of throws some people to thinking it's a guitar, but it's like a big mandolin. And then I got the fiddle I use.
How many instruments did you play on this new record?
Well, actual instruments, I don't know. There was two or three different guitars anyway, and then there was a couple different bouzoukis, but it's banjo, mandolin, fiddle, bouzouki. Is that it? Five.
Which one do you like playing the most?
I don't know. I like playing the fiddle for fun at home, and I like it, you know, it's kind of a more of a playing for dances kind of thing. That's what it's good for, but I like playing it in a bluegrass band, but I'm the singer, so it's kind of hard for me to be the fiddler and the singer at the same time. I approximate a little bit here and there, playing and singing at the same time. But I guess I like the guitar mostly. You know, when I'm by myself, it's just kind of a fun thing. That's the first thing I started playing.
The roots music world these days seems to be thriving with a lot of young players.
Yeah.
You know, the Ducks, the Mammals, Punch Brothers. Do you think it's in good hands?
Yes, we have mammals and birds, and we need some amphibians. I guess we got the iguanas.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, it's in good hands. The kids coming up are really doing good stuff with the music. They're kind of turning it around, and you know, they reinvigorate it. They effervesce it, kind of. I don't know. It's funny because in a way of old folk songs, like a song like "Pretty Maid in the Garden," song I recorded for Fiddler's Green. That one sort of, I don't know why, that and "Moonshiner" people have been singing that the last several years. All across the board. It's like maybe those songs were ignored for a while, and then for me, some songs are too well known, like "Banks of the Ohio," so I never really touched them. But then the kids, they didn't, you know, sort of one generation kind of ignored it because it was overdone. Then the songs come back and they sound great again. I mean, that's just one thing that happens. But like the kids always had something different to it, and not just to the enthusiasm that comes with youth, but they also have a different perspective on it, you know, and they know about other kind of music that I don't know about, or that the generation older than me certainly didn't know about. So they kind of add a little of that in, kind of sneak it in, and it makes it sound better sometimes.
We talked about the younger people getting into this music. Why do you think, though, mainstream country radio and the mainstream country world seems to not really touch the bluegrass world or the acoustic roots music world?
Well, this music is made for another audience, you know. It's just a different thing. You know, that stuff on country radio, mainstream kind of corporate radio, it's like, it's been said, it's sort of music to sell tires to, you know. And, you know, it's punchy. It's like 3 minutes, it's done. There's a hook within the first 10 seconds, and people are driving. They're going, I might buy a tire. But if they're going to sing, you know, if I'm going to sing about Fair Margaret and William or whatever it is, that song, you know, about ghosts and blood and all this kind of stuff, it's not going to sell very many tires. But I'm glad that there's an audience for it, nonetheless.
I really thought that when the success of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou happened, that maybe the mainstream country world would have grasped onto that, but they really didn't. I was sort of surprised.
No, they were, they were so reluctant to play those records, even though they were top sellers. It's really funny. I actually heard the big hit, I'm a Man of Constant Sorrow, on Drive Time Radio in D.C. one day. And it was after, well after they had sold so many records. And it showed that, that country radio was kind of irrelevant. It was like a, you know, big Grammy winner, and it was one of the biggest selling records of that year. Oh Brother, and Down from the Mountain that accompanied it. And that all happened in spite of radio. It happened because there was a movie star that did the video and acted like he was singing a traditional bluegrass song. Yeah. George Clooney in your video doesn't hurt a bit.
Can we get you to do another one?
Yeah, I'll do another song. That's what I'm here for, Chris. Why don't you do it in the circle, do it in the square, do it in the tux or in your underwear? Nobody's watching, nobody cares, so just get out there and dance. Why don't you do it with your feet, do it with your hands, do it to a record, you can do it to a band. What part of boogie don't you understand? I said get out there and dance. You gotta get out there, you gotta get in the groove. Let things get loose, let everything move. Your head starts to bob and your toes start to tap and your hands start to clap. And now anything can happen, so step it to the left, step it to the right. Shimmy with your shoulders and your hips all night. Long as you're doing it, you're doing it right. I said, get out there and dance. All you can do it to a polka, do it to a waltz, do it in a line with some guy shouting calls. If you don't have fun, it's your own damn fault. I said, get out there and dance. I'll do it in the morning or in the afternoon, underneath the chandelier or underneath the moon. If you don't have music, hum yourself a tune. I said, get out there and dance. You gotta get out there, get in the groove. Let things get loose, let every last thing move. Your head starts to bobbing, your toes start to tapping, your hands start to clapping. Now anything can happen, so step it to the left, step it to the right. Shimmy with your shoulders and your hips all night. Long as you're doing it, you're doing it right. Get out in there and dance. Da do da do 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 da do 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 da do 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 da do 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 do. You gotta, don't forget to, whatever you do, folks, you gotta get out there and dance. Also grab yourself a partner and give the hand a tug. Do it on a carpet or you can cut a rug. Or just do it, friends, till you catch that bug. I said, get out there and dance. Learn from Arthur Murray or Dancing with the Stars. Learn from Fred Astaire. You can learn from Ginger Rogers. Learn it from the youngsters and learn it from old codgers. But get out there and dance. You gotta get out there. You gotta get in the groove. Let things get loose. Let every last thing move. Your head starts to bobbing. Your toes start to tapping. Your hands start to clapping. Now anything can happen, so step it to the left, step it to the right. Shimmy with your shoulders and your hips all night. Long as you're doing it, you're doing it right. Just get out there and dance, Lord, Lord. Get out and dance.
Tim O'Brien performing in the Folk Alley Studios. Tim, in 2005, you won a Grammy Award for your album Fiddler's Green. What was that like?
That was fantastic. It's like nothing else in the world. There's some other things you could compare it to, but I wouldn't want to talk about them on, on a PBS show.
Did you go to the ceremony and everything?
Yeah, I was there. I was there. It's the folk award and sort of lesser awards, the lesser, pop awards, non-pop awards are given out in the afternoon before the broadcast. And it's actually nice because you get more time to hang out and with people, and people get more time on stage and stuff than they do during the broadcast. So it's kind of nice, it's like the contemporary folks. I remember I saw Ry Cooter kind of hanging around. I went, wow, cool, Ry Cooter's here. Awesome. And then Del McCurry, we were sitting down by those guys. Those guys won the Grammy for Bluegrass. And then they announced my name. And then they announced John Prine. So all my buddies were winning that year. It was great.
That's pretty good company to be in.
Yeah, it was great.
Were you surprised?
Oh, yeah, I was very surprised. Well, it's a political contest. As much as it is supposed to be about the merit of the music and everything, it's really mostly about who's most famous, and usually. And in the case of this, in that year, the Chieftains had a tribute to Derek Bell, and Derek Bell had just died, and God, the money was on the Chieftains for that year, I'd think, in my category. But somehow I won. So I was really happy about it. And, I just couldn't – I, you know how it is when you don't want to let on that you really want one of these things. You go, well, I got nominated. That's great. I won already. And you do. You win that way. And you get to go to the big party if you want to go to the Grammys and all that stuff. But and I'd been there three times before, or two other times. I've been nominated three times. So this time I thought, well, they might call my name, but probably not. And then they called my name and went, wow, this is incredible.
It hasn't always been like this, though, for you. I know that you were signed to a major label in the early 90s, RCA, yeah. And they dropped you before they even released anything from
right.
you, right?
What Maybe that was there? A good idea for both of us, for both RCA and for me. But, it's just one of those things. You learn a lot of lessons. I wasn't ready for prime time. Maybe I never will be.
Were you hoping, though, for that kind of
No, I was hoping that I could, gain a foothold like Lyle Lovett did or John Hartford did when he was on a major years ago. And, from there on, you can sort of keep going. And you get a heightened awareness of your stuff if you're on a major. If there's interest in the record, it can be ignored just as much as an indie can be.
So what was the reasoning?
Well, there was an administration change, and the stuff that was – I was kind of signed in the wake of stuff like Nancy Griffiths and Lyle Lovett being signed out of Nashville. And then people like Garth Brooks – Clint Black was really big right then, and Garth Brooks was coming on. That's what they really wanted to pay attention to was kind of the hat acts, and I wasn't going that way at all. So I was just not – the administration changed. My sponsor was gone. My record was just done, and they went – what's this? The new guy goes, let me get back to you. And he never did.
Wow.
So it was fine.
Well, you picked up your guitar. How about another song?
I've got the guitar. I'm going to use the finger picks too. And I'm going to play a tune that's of my own making. This is called Father Forgive Me. It's kind of about me going through life without a clue, without a plan. They say if you want to make God laugh, you make a plan. I make him laugh all the time.
Judas kiss. Jesus needs him, don't you see? In midnight garden of agony, it's midnight garden of agony. He says there's a job I gotta do, and I'm gonna need a little help from you. If I'm gonna free this world from sin, somebody gonna have to turn me in. Somebody gonna have to turn me in. Father, forgive me, I never knew. I never saw that coming, no, I never do. I'm gonna bow my head and gonna say her name. Just a pawn in a bigger game. Just a pawn in a bigger game. Had me friends in a big old band. his hands. They had all the girls had the cocaine too. I took out the fiddle, played them all I knew. I took out the fiddle, played them all I knew. I never got that gig even though I tried. Well, it's just as well, cause I might have died. Things aren't always what they seem. When you walk in a fog and you live in a dream, you walk in a fog and you live in a dream like me. Father, forgive me, I never knew. I never saw that coming, no, I never do. I'm gonna bow my head and gonna say your name. Just a pawn in a bigger game. I'm just a pawn in a bigger game. Buzzing around a flower, she has no idea it's her finest hour. She had no idea about the greater scheme. She's just sucking up nectar for the queen, sucking up nectar for the queen. And that first time you spoke to me, I never knew how big our love could be. Who knew how far love could go? And where it ends, we'll never know. Where it ends, we'll never know. Father, forgive me, I never knew. I never saw that coming, no, I never do. I'm gonna bow my head and gonna say your name. I'm just a pawn in a bigger game. Just a pawn in a bigger game. I'm just a pawn in a bigger game. Just a pawn in a bigger game.
Tim O'Brien performing Father Forgive Me in the Folk Alley Studios. Tim, lately you've been showing up on a lot of records as producer. You produced The Ducks, the infamous String Dusters, Robin and Linda Williams. How do you approach producing someone else's record?
Well, everybody's got their different set of situations, I guess. You know, you sort of have some artists want a real hands-on producer to help with arrangements, to pick songs, come up with the general vibe of the record. I mean, but most of the people I work with have a real good idea about what they're doing. And my job is just to set up the conditions for their success, you know, try to minimize the pitfalls and, you know, emphasize their strengths and that kind of thing. And it's great. I really like it because somebody pointed out that it's a kind of a, your ego kind of gets left on the side, and it's a great thing because you don't have to worry about, well, this is not my record. I'm just trying to do what they want to do and do it the best way you can possibly do it. And it's great because everybody, you know, and you learn stuff. You learn all kind of stuff about how music works and how people think about music, how they, you know, conceive of it, and their viewpoints. And it's valuable for me. It helps me with my own music. But it's great fun to see it start and end. Because usually on my own projects, I'm thinking about everything for a year or 2 years about what I'm going to do. And I'm guessing, you know, I'm asking myself questions, 1,000 questions every, you know, hour. And with this, it's like, well, I just say, was that good or was that not good? And what can we do to make it better? It's the same questions, but I'm only concentrating on this one project for, say, a month at a time, and it's kind of nice. It's a nice break for me, and I've learned a lot.
Is it hard kind of being the boss, though? I mean, do you ever have to say, you know, that song isn't maybe good enough for this record?
Yeah, that's when it's hard. What you want is, and this is how the great producers in Nashville are. You know, like when you're working for them, they go, you go, well, you wait for them to say something, they go, sounds really good. They don't seem to do anything because they've just got it. They just sort of herded it into the situation, or they herded, you know, got the group to sort of say, hey, I really like that song. Why don't we work on that for a while? And then, you know, just gently guiding the thing. And you're kind of a, a little bit of a cheerleader sometimes, and it depends on the artist. It's different every time. It's fascinating.
We talked about all the different hats you wear, you know, record producer, multi-instrumentalist, songwriter, singer, band leader, performer. Which one of those do you like wearing the most?
Well, I like the performing an awful lot, Chris, and I'd hate to give that up. At the same time, I'm kind of looking for ways to stay home more often, and, you know, it's harder and harder to get on the road and, you know, keep that schedule up. And so I'm looking for ways to stay home, and one of those ways is writing. One of those ways is producing and recording on other people's recordings. And, you know, I'm looking for more of that and a little less touring. But, you know, I don't think the touring will ever go away because I really like the communication. You communicate when you're playing music somehow, I think, no matter what. If there's any audience at all for the music, then whether it's, if they're listening to a record, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. And you're communicating, but there's no... When you're on stage and there's an audience there, you have this kind of back and forth thing that it's hard to get any other way. And so I would hate to give that up.
Well, Tim O'Brien, thank you so much for stopping by here today at Folk Alley. We really appreciate it. How about one more song to close us out here?
I'd like to play another song for you. This is called "Where's Love Come From," and this is made up from parts of older folk songs. I think, you know, a little bit of Cluck Oldham, little Love Is Pleasing, a little bit of Woody Guthrie here and there, and then hopefully the recycled parts add up to a new song.
Where's love come from? Where's love go? What feeds love and what makes it grow? It's all we need and we need to know. Where's love come from? Where's love go? I used to have a gal live down below. Used to go to see her, but I don't no more. I let fear close up my heart. Love fell away and we fell apart. Love is handsome and love is kind. Love is simple, it's so sublime. But love cannot live on its own. You gotta make love feel at home. Where'd love come from? Where'd love go? What feeds love and what makes it grow? It's all we need and we need to know. Where's love come from? Where's love go? When I saw love walking down the road, it had a worried mind, it had a heavy, heavy load. There's two hearts outside of town. It's been too long since I came around. If I get there before too late, they might not fill their hearts with hate. I'll knock on the door if they let me in. There's a real good chance that love can win. Where's love come from? Where's love go? What feeds love and what makes it grow? That's all we need and we need to know. Where's love come from? Where's love go? My mama died 2 years ago. She told her children, here I go. Said the hardest thing in life I do is try to say goodbye to you. Sister was there for her last breath. She said it was a very peaceful death. But mama's love, it lives on and on. It's like some never-ending song. Where's love come from? Where's love go? What feeds love and what makes it grow? It's all we need and we need to know. Where's love come from? Where'd love come from? Where'd love go? What feeds love or what makes it grow? It's all we need and we need to know. Where's love come from? Where's love go?
All right.
Cool, man.
All right. We've done it.